Welcome to another of our special fourth anniversary best of presentations here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. This is Adam Lepp. Thank you for joining us today. Well, when you work at WWGH Radio, usually we do shows at our studios in the great city of Marion. Some of us have home studios like myself where we do some or all of a program, but sometimes we take the show on the road. We've been to Cleveland to broadcast live from the Republican convention that happened in 2016, but alas, we've taken trips farther than that. Scott Terry and Sean went to the Big Apple, New York City, in late May of 2017. To speak with some very famous people, innovators in their field. Let's start with an excerpt from Scott's talk with talk show pioneer, Mr. Phil Donahue.
29 years, over 5,000 shows. The first show on AIDS, the first issue-oriented talk show, the first guy to go out into the audience with a microphone to know what you, what was on your mind, had to say in our own state, Dayton, Ohio. He is an icon. It is not without question to say that every time we do a show on politics or issues, that if this man had not been around, I couldn't do it. And you have no idea what a thrill it is to be sitting right across from the man himself. He doesn't do these very often, so I am very thrilled to sit across from Phil Donahue. Whoever thought I would say that? Mr. Donahue.
Pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
I was afraid you wouldn't be able to read my handwriting.
Phil, I wanted to ask you right off the bat. I took this tip from you, just asking a real hard hitter right off the bat. Why don't, for somebody who did a talk show for 29 years, why don't you do many shows as a guest?
Well, tell you the truth. I don't get that. I'm not that hot, you know. I'm yesterday's warmed over cereal. I'm considered a liberal. And liberals are scolds, you know. They're always complaining. Many liberals don't believe in God. Liberals don't support our troops. And it's not a very popular thing to be. Evidence Fox News and the Fox News Channel and the success that they've enjoyed. I'm not out there begging for attention. So it's a difficult point to make without sounding a little bit self-indulgent here. Maybe I'm not invited to many places because I'm not that popular. But it's also true that liberals, you know, consider nobody, you've never seen Amy Goodman, for example, on Meet the Press. Dennis Kucinich has disappeared. Bill Moyers hangs on and has invited me, and I did his show. I substituted for him, so I'm very grateful for that. But it is just a fact that America's most popular among the conservative viewpoint. Conservatives are tough. They support it. They love America. They support the president. And, you know, we're arguing that in many ways we think we're more patriotic than they are. We believe in the First Amendment. We believe in We believe that the Senate and the House should confirm war making. We don't think it should be done by one president in an office. And that just doesn't fly today as much as the patriotic conservative viewpoint. And that's the nature of our society at this time. I don't want to overstate this because there are a lot of heroic, in fact, we call ourselves progressive now. Conservative or liberal is the political idea that dare not speak its name. And progressives are just more popular today, are less popular than conservatives. So much so that we've changed our name. We don't use the L word anymore. We're no longer liberals. We're progressives. So excuse you for breathing. I'm progressive.
It's interesting, though, Phil. You were on the air 29 years. You had an audience. Mm-hmm. You owned it for a long time. Does that mean the audience was more progressive and liberal then?
Well, that's a good question, and I can't say that it does mean that. The reason we finally took off, we started, as you know, in Dayton, Ohio. God bless Dayton, Ohio. Not on a navigable river, a town built on brains. NCR, the National Cash Register Company, the Wright brothers, Charles Kettering, invented the starter motor, and others that I'm leaving out. And we had a largely female audience because it was a daytime show. And back in those days, mom stayed home and dad went off to a mysterious place in a high building to go to work and do important things. Mom went to the basement to do the wash. That's a little bit of an elitist example. Not everybody had a basement then. And we knew we were dull. We were visually dull. We were up against spinning wheels and come on down. And, you know, Monty Hall was giving away $5,000 to a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich. And I'm here with one talking head, just as we are right now. We were visually dull. So we figured out that the only thing that would save us, and we weren't sure we were going to survive in Dayton, the only thing that would save us were issues about which our audience, largely female audience, cared. And so we started with Madeline Murray O'Hara, who was our first guest.
The atheist.
Mm-hmm. I'm out of Notre Dame about, I guess, something like 10 years. And Madeline leans forward, looks at me, and says, "There is no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell." This is their first show. "There are no angels. When you die, you go in the ground, you biodegrade, and you become part of the physical universe." Well, the building fell in Dayton, Ohio. I'm still getting holy pictures. People are still praying for me. But everybody knew there was this new show on Channel 2 in Dayton, Ohio. And then as the week went on, we put a gay guy on in 1967, a real live homosexual right here on my show. And I was, of course, scared to death because I thought, you know, people are going to think I'm there goes my career. And, you know, sure enough, the third caller said, "How's Phil look to you?" And a little old lady in downtown Dayton that afternoon said, "Well, who's your friend?" And I look back now at how really anxious I was then. We put another gay guy on, and that went through the roof. And another, and then we realized we were meeting a lot of nice people. And, you know, I always had this label of being I guess, progressive. Thank you very much. And I slowly came to realize that this was a civil rights issue. That why does it bother me about being with a gay person? What's going on here? And suddenly our program established a very good relationship or reputation within the politically active gay community. And in the 90s, actually the 80s, I got the first GLAAD Media Award. It was given at the, not far from where we're broadcasting, in Midtown at the Time Life Hospitality Room. There were probably 12 people there. I got my picture taken with the plaque, and I'm really very proud of it. 25 years after receiving that plaque, GLAAD called and said, would you come, August 20th, would you come to the 20th anniversary of having received the first GLAAD Award? Sure. So I went to one of the largest ballrooms in the city of New York. And I walked in, and the red carpet with the paparazzi, there were more paparazzi there than there were people when I got my first award. And every table, not an empty chair, wall-to-wall tables, and the whole ballroom, around the ballroom, were logos of Fortune 500 companies. Mm. IBM, American Airlines, Mobil Oil, all around. And I couldn't get over the warp speed of this revolution. I just was, and I was very proud to be a small part of this effort. And along the way, met some fabulous people. And if there's one thing I'm proud of as a result of the history, and I get a lot of attention now, no sad songs for me. I mean, people come up to me in airports all the time, you know. Mr. Donahue, I'm Mr. Donahue now, so you want to keep that in mind, Scott. Mr. Donahue, thank you for your show. Because of your show, I got out of an abusive marriage. Thank you for your show, Mr. Donahue. Because of your show, I came out to my parents. And one of the comments I'm getting more and more often lately is, thank you, Mr. Donahue. Because of your show, I learned to speak English.
Well said. Not too many people whom I enjoy hearing English being spoken by than Mr. Phil Donahue. So nice of him to join Scott and Sean at the hotel for an interesting discussion, and one that I think will be a lifetime memory for all of us here at the station, as well as you, the listener. Let's switch species. Humans being Homo sapiens, but we share this great world with many other types of animals. And not too many people are more of an expert on other members of the animal kingdom than Jim Fowler.
When you look back at your career, where do you rate that? Where do you rate that? Because everybody sees it. Everybody loves it.
Well, not to make a long answer out of that, but I went to a college in Indiana named Earlham. It was a liberal arts college. And when I got out, one of the diseases I say I got was nobody told me what I couldn't do. That's quite a disease, and maybe you got that too. Yeah. But no, anyway, I set off, and I didn't really plan a lot of that. I was a zoologist, and I had a big, big interest in birds of prey. So I started off doing things that I had an opportunity to do and I wanted to do, but in the mid-50s, when I graduated, you could follow your dreams. So I tell people when I speak, I say, by golly, that's the way America should be, and everybody applauds. But it was true for me. I lectured at a Birds of Prey attraction in Ocala, Florida. Somebody that I had been my mentor opened up this attraction. And from there, somebody asked me to go to Africa to do a documentary film. So I would have given my right arms in my mid to late 20s. And so I pushed off on a freighter for 28 days getting to Africa. And he told me when I got about halfway across that what he wanted me to do was to live trap lions. And he wanted to be the first white hunter to shoot a lion in a full charge, unwounded lion. Now, lions were killing some of the natives in those days, so it was not unusual to do that. But anyway, I trapped lions and came back and was on the Today Show. The steamship line wanted me to be on the Today Show, so I was on that and made that connection. And then I went to the Amazon and did the first studies on the harpy eagle, which is the largest eagle in the world. It feeds on 30-pound monkeys, among other things, big eagles, and came back, and Marlon Perkins saw me on the Today Show with those big eagles, and so that's when he asked me to come to Chicago and start Wild Kingdom.
When you first went on television, when you made that Today Show appearance, what did they tell you? You weren't in broadcasting. How did you think it went?
Well, I had, even before that, I had been around, I'd lectured with animals in the beginning, and I knew a little bit about it. I think my first appearance, was down, there used to be a reptile specialist whose name was Ross Allen in Ocala, Florida, and he had a reptile place, and I used to lecture a little bit with him, and Marlon Perkins had a program in the 50s called Zoo Parade, and Marlon came down there to Florida because he was also a reptile specialist. Marlon was. We call them herpetologists. So they came over, and my first appearance on television, I remember quite well. I was standing, with an eagle. I was standing beside Marlon Perkins and my host, whose name was John Hamlet. And John Hamlet said to Marlon on camera, he said, "Marlon, I'll have the boy go get the eagle." You know, in those days, I was called the boy, even though I was 6 foot six and quite old, elderly. But anyway, that was my first appearance on television, being called the boy, getting the eagle. Yeah.
Had the television experience not happened, what do you think would have happened?
Well, I had several opportunities as a zoologist. I wasn't absolutely sure about going on television. I mean, I was living an adventurous life. I live with a Kalahari Bushman in Africa, and got along with them pretty well. They had never seen anybody train an eagle, so I caught an eagle and trained it in Africa and used to hunt with it, jackals.
Oh,
so they invited me to stay with them, and anyway, I wasn't necessarily thinking of television, all those adventures that I had, but I was able to pursue adventures. Yeah.
What did television do for you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the reason in the beginning I was showing animals and talking about them, and that was probably enough to talk about animals. But about probably 10 to 15 years ago, I figured out if I had an audience, I better know what I'm talking about. So I broadened it and began talking about what's in it for us. Why does the natural world, how does that benefit human welfare? That's the key to the whole thing. And very few people and very few conservation organizations link human welfare with the messages they're sending. They're talking about saving animals and saving plants and all that, but it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense unless you link what's in it for humans, because we humans, as you obviously know, are pretty self-oriented. And you can go around talking about saving a lion or a tiger or an eagle or whatever, but it sort of rubs off their back. We right now, they did a survey a few years ago, and they questioned how many people get out in the outdoors, but less than 5% of the American public spend more than a half an hour a year thinking about the welfare of open space, wildlife, and wilderness. That's because there's so many other activities that are being marketed so effectively to the public. Who's out there marketing the natural world?
Yeah. You know, when I was coming here to New York, I see so much land that is not developed, not housing developments or things like that.
Yeah.
It's everywhere, but we don't pay attention to it. Is it just, are we just too worried about ourselves to care?
Well, the key to it is that, you know, to put it in perspective, when we first landed on this continent, a squirrel could go from the East Coast to the Midwest without touching the ground. And so we have opened it up an awful lot. And, you know, our pioneer spirit was to clear everything, cut down the trees, and we did an amazing job. Most of the trees that you're seeing now are second growth. You know, the real primary virgin forests really are very rare. And, you know, I know a few places in America where you still have that, and they're amazing. But anyway, our pursuit was to take advantage of the natural world and to exploit it. And we've done a pretty good job of that. But there are now some concerns about what happens. In the, E.O. Wilson is a scientist that's very ecologist that talks about this, and I talk about it. But the fact is that if we put pavement on half of this planet, it's downhill from then on. And that's what people don't understand, is that the natural world, for a lot of reasons, is critical to the survival of the human race.
Why is it that I was telling you before we went on, when I was growing up, everybody wanted to be a vet.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to be, they wanted to work at a zoo. I tell you, 2 weeks ago, I was in a grocery store, and a girl was telling me, because we live close to Columbus, she's got a summer job at the zoo, and she's so excited because that's where she wants to go.
Yeah.
But it's not when I say, oh, I say, what are you going to do? There's really nothing more than that. It's just the idea of being around animals. Why doesn't it get bigger?
Well, there are some people at zoos that obviously have a bigger picture that they're going for. And the Bronx Zoo out here, I've known the director out there lately, and he has actually a television show now that's playing in this area. But anyway, there's very seldom anything said on a television show like his about what's in it for us. And that's the key thing that I've been talking a lot about.
The amazing Kreskin. Many years ago, when I was a young lad, my parents and I used to love watching his TV specials. It is surreal that in 2018, I'm doing a best of presentation for a radio station where I wear many hats, but one of them is doing highlight shows like this, and I get to put in an excerpt from a man whose career has amazed me since the 1970s. Also meeting with Scott, Terry, and Sean in the Big Apple in late May of 2017, the amazing, the one and only, Kreskin.
Scott, reach down and cut the cards. Reach down one hand. With your other hand, turn the pile over in your hand. Put a face up. Put a face up on there.
Put a face up on there. Okay.
You have no idea what you cut to.
No,
I don't. No idea on the face of the earth.
No.
Spread the cards out. Just the face-up ones. Just the face-up ones.
Okay, spread them out.
All right. Okay. All the way. All the way.
All the way out here on the table.
To the card you cut to.
The card I cut.
Take out the card you cut to. The face down.
Okay.
Got it. Just the face card one. The face card you cut to. Just cut.
Got it.
Take the card off the deck.
Okay.
What's the card?
The card is the Two of Hearts.
And I want you to know, and by the way, he just cut, turned the deck over, and that's what you can, by the way, see that these cards are mixed. Would you take the deck out and take the Two of Hearts out, and I want you to hand that to Scott. Just take the Two of Hearts out of the deck, spread through it since it's not even shuffled, and hand the Two of Hearts to Scott, please, if you will. Will you?
Yeah. Now this is Sean. He's been holding the deck the whole time.
The whole time.
He's looking for the Two of Hearts here.
Yeah. Hand it to him, Sean.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah, you got the cards in order.
Yes. You got this deck here he's had. Where's the old Two of Hearts in there? It's not in there.
You can see the cards in order, can't you? What, hearts?
All hearts.
What's missing in the row of hearts? Ace? The two. That's the one card missing from the deck, and you cut to it. You cut 18 cards down, which is exactly where. And if I had given you a chance to think, you would have started to analyze, but you just unconsciously responded to my mental suggestion, and you counted.
Isn't that two hearts. That's fascinating.
The dealers in Vegas say they go crazy. They'll leave a deck in front of me and say, they'll name a card, and I can cause them to cut to it, even though I can't see the deck. So I thought you'd find
that. That's fascinating.
By the way, and Scott agreed to this, and we got witnesses here. Scott agreed that after the program here, folks, we'll have a little bit of time. He's going to play a game of poker with me. I wouldn't even touch the...
I don't know. I left my wallet in my other pants.
You notice how Scott got out of this and said he left his wallet somewhere?
I left my wallet someplace else.
But through the years of the Mike Douglas Show, and Ailes had this as a rule, there was always a deck of cards on the table. He says, Kreskin, because what you do with the mind is not sleight of hand, that you can control people's I thought you'd find that interesting.
That is fascinating. And Kreskin, how long do you want to keep on keeping on?
Well, I'm 82 degrees now. I'm 82 degrees.
About 30 degrees in here today.
I like it like this, but I'm 82 years old, and I still jog. I jogged last night, although it was a crazy night in New York because I had an appearance. But I've announced finally when I'm going to retire, and I've made it public. I plan to retire 10 days after I pass away.
Is that right? But the bookings will be good that week because you'll be in the papers. It'll be a good week for you.
Oh, boy, do I like his sense of humor.
It'll be a brilliant thing.
But, you know, if you knew my schedule, you would say it was crazy. But it's not that I'm not a workaholic. It's just when you enjoy your work, so much of what you touch. I'm working on my 21st book now. I'm negotiating some other areas which are interesting, and I'm working and we're going to be doing a commercial in the next 4 weeks in an area which I think will be interesting.
I've never asked you this before, Kreskin. Yeah. Is there anything you have not done you still want to do?
That's interesting because most of the things that have happened that have been exciting to me, I haven't thought of doing. I'll tell you what I'd like to do. Now, I've performed in Trump's home. I've been in Trump's home, and I've Hillary Clinton's been around all these people and so forth. I would like to now, because I performed in the past for some presidents, and I've been around Trump, I'd like to sit with some of the key heads of state in this country and not speak to them. And just have someone ask him one or two questions, because I would like to see what the real answers I get. I don't mean that I look down upon politicians. I know I've said a lot of crazy things on shows, but I happen to personally wish that more politicians had been on the Titanic.
Well, there we go. I guess it could be. You know, Kreskin, before we wrap up, because it's been a pleasure to be in person with you.
And you know, we finally got to
Finally got together. By the way, high excitement.
By the way, we're going to get a picture later on, although when you develop them, I'm done. I don't cast reflections. but I the thing I told you about the under the table thing for a special, we're very, very excited about this. And there's a number of people bidding on it. But I think it's going to be fascinating to people to see this and some of the other things that intrigue Carson, you know.
Tremendous. Yeah. But before you go, because we always do this on the phone, and I always try to get something in because I want to know an answer about something. My question is, a lot of people have asked this. You always predict the presidents. Yeah. We always love to know that when you do that every year. But a lot of people want to know, because of what they think happened or didn't happen last time, will Hillary Clinton ever run again for a public office? Maybe mayor of the city we're in right now. Will Hillary Clinton run for public office again? Kreskin, I came to New York for this.
He came to New York for this.
Yes.
Now, you know, I must tell you, I can't. I've been involved in a lot of political discussions, and I can't really say what's going on. But I will say this: the career of Hillary Clinton has not ended, as we learn more and more about the conversations. And I can't tell you the name of the writer who has written about what was going on while it was getting closer and closer to the end of the election, hours or two before. When we hear this style of hers, you're going to see a new Hillary Clinton within a year or so that you never quite saw that persona before, because I don't think she can hide it much longer. End of commentary. You'll have to read what I said.
That is it.
I'm not joking. That remark was not a joke.
That's fascinating. But
remember what I said to you now, the way I said it. And I've held this back, but no, you're going to see another side. She will not leave the public eye, but it's going to be very interesting.
A whole new thing. Oh, you want to tell me, Kreskin?
Totally,
you want to tell
not
me?
Not totally new. No.
Not totally new.
No.
But will the monogram towels of the next mayor of New York be HC?
No.
No. No.
Of the next mayor of New York?
Mayor of New York.
The next mayor of New York. Don't get me involved in that.
Oh, my goodness, Kreskin. We tried to get it out of you.
The mayor was angry with me when I fought the business of horse and buggies in town, you know, because he wanted to ban the horses pulling. But in England, they'd done it for years, and he felt this is the house of horses and everything else. And again, it's not that I can't stand politicians, but I went on the front page stories in some of the newspapers here in New York. I said, we got to allow horse and buggies. They've carried people through town. Then it was found out later on, when that bill didn't go through, that one of the people involved in that was a relative of the mayor's, let's say a brother who wanted to build where the stable was a restaurant with a hotel and everything else. It's not that there's politics behind everything. It's just that there's politics behind almost anything.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask, because
this guy is not stopping.
No. We got 30 left.
By the way, and he's holding a gun.
Because my contention
is a quiet gun there.
My contention has always been that I think Hillary Clinton, whether you like her or hate her, is such a driven person.
She very much is.
I don't think she can just sit at home.
I don't believe it. Oh, please don't even think that way. More so than her husband, who has an ease about him and a way of communicating that has a naturalness. That was a very the blaming it on Trump or what he said or some other people why she lost the election. I would like to see this happen. If I were to sit down with the president, I would not expect ever to be asked this. I'll tell you what I'd like to see happen. In the 1940s, when we were in a world war, and the FDR was president, he did press conferences. But listen to what he did. Not a montage of people asking questions all over the place. He sat in front of a bare microphone in the White House and had fireside chats where he talked to the American people. I know, because Orson Welles helped write some of those chats. And we felt, like live radio is, that he was talking only to us. I think that needs to come back. I'm not knocking the press. They've been tremendously good to me. When you have different, and sometimes questions have an answer in them, an opinion in them, so forth. Let the president talk heart to heart. I think we need that once again. And even Winston Churchill did that, who I think was the greatest political leader of the last century. I've read over 1,000. If we had listened to him, we would have been more prepared, but we don't listen to history or even something in the past.
What more can you say? After all these times on the telephone, Kreskin, to meet you in person is a tremendous thrill for me and an honor.
Well,
and that's
I want to say this, and I always say this when we leave, and I'll say this in my final words, but we're sitting in a hotel room, and it's so comfortable doing this because what do we have, about 30 seconds
left? Yeah, we got that, yeah.
I had a hero when I was a kid named Arthur Godfrey, who changed all of broadcasting. As Rooney said before he died, after 60 Minutes, those last years, he said the man changed. He made everyone feel like they were at home with him because he knew a person listening to him wasn't conversing at a party. They were listening to him. And a lot of people in broadcasting today who have made the shows almost mechanical have lost that. The shows have lost heart. And this is even some of the variety talk shows. But I won't say goodbye to you in the spirit of broadcasting, as I always say. Just let's say to be continued.
Last, but certainly not least, one of Scott's favorite guests, legendary actress. She was Ursula in The Little Mermaid. She was on one of my favorite shows, Too Close for Comfort. Of course, Pat Carroll. Scott, Sean, and Terry traveled all the way to Cape Cod to visit with the one and only Pat Carroll.
Did you give advice?
I'm sure I did, but I kept saying to myself, butt your nose out. This is a business where you have to learn on your own. I don't care what kind of advice people give you. Every actor's experience in this profession is unique to them, has nothing to do with you. So the only advice you can give them is keep your nose to the grindstone. Make sure the check's passed, you know. But I gave very little advice, except obviously you want to do it. And wanting to do it is the major thing. You learn everything else as you do it.
Do you ever see, when you're watching her, things you did that she maybe picked up by just seeing Mom, who was an actress?
By osmosis.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
You do.
And it tickles me, because her comedy in particular, I think she watched my comedy to mimic it. The drama comes right out of her. I can't even compete with her as a serious actress. She's marvelous. But in comedy, I see a little bit of me, only because she was very young, and she was a kid. Of course, she was going to mimic Mama, you know. But I'm very proud of her, and I'm very proud for another reason. She has a reputation, and I think this is the reason that many directors hire her. A set that she works on is never an unhappy set. And I think that is a tremendous compliment. Because actors can be a real pain in the neck. And if you allow an actor or an actress to go a little wild in their behavior as a human being on a set, you can be in trouble. She has never been that, because she learned from me, you behave yourself on a set because you're not the only actor there. A lot of actors are there, and you're part of a group. So don't you get too high and mighty. And she never has. She's wonderful. And many directors hire her because she brings lightness to a set. She brings humor to a set. She brings good feeling. Because we're all still human beings. Come on. This is not a torture chamber we're working in. Relax, everybody. This is the work you love to do. Relax and do it. I admire my daughter in this profession highly, and she knows it because I've told her how much I admire her. And she does good, wonderful work, both comedically and dramatically. In fact, I think she's almost a better dramatic actress than she is a comedian.
What did you consider yourself? Not what you did the
Lucky.
Most of. There you go. Talented. Talented.
I don't know about
Talented.
That. All you do is do the work, and you leave it up to other people to say whether you're talented or not. You don't say that. All you do is you know you love the work, and you do it. Now, how people receive that is up to them.
I don't know if I've ever relayed this story, and I'm going to do it now because it's of what you just said. Years ago, when I was a child, I was watching Designing Women. Now, people will remember the great show with Dixie Carter and Annie Potts.
That's right. That's right. Good cast.
Very good cast. A lot of Emmys on that show.
Right.
There was an episode late in the run where Julia, I remember this. I'm going to tell you why I remember this so well. Julia, who was Dixie Carter's character,
right,
had an old school marm who came to stay with her because her husband had died.
Right.
And wouldn't leave the house.
Right.
Mrs. Beecham. I remembered her name. Mrs. Beecham.
I didn't even remember it.
No notes. Mrs. Beecham. Mrs. Beecham is the meanest, nastiest woman you'll ever want to meet. Mrs. Beecham is also the funniest woman and it's Pat Carroll, by the way, if you hadn't guessed that. And I, at that point, you know, I'm Little Mermaid, I'm Make Room for Daddy, I know very well who you are, but I didn't see you in that role.
Of course.
It's hilarious.
Isn't it wonderful?
Oh.
You know, the mean roles are the best roles. And any actress worth her salt is going to fight to play the villainess or the mean woman because they're the meat. Mm. That's where you get the stuff going. Oh, it's wonderful to be sweet and darling and adorable and the ingenue. Good luck to you. But be mean, and you got it made, and you're going to have a ball doing it.
The three roles that I remember Pat Carroll in the most are that one, of course, Ursula, and Mary Tyler Moore's roommate.
Oh, wasn't she dreadful?
All mean ladies.
Yeah.
But
and
you're
you
not.
You know, I got hate mail for the Mary
oh.
show because how dare you treat our Mary that way? I got hate mail.
Oh, my gosh.
And I told Mary, and I showed her the letters. And I said, I'm not working your show again. Isn't that funny?
It's true because when you are mean on camera and believably mean, you're that person.
That's right.
You're that person. When you came in to The Little Mermaid, 1989, everybody's a voice actor now. Not so then. Not so. How did that come to you? Ursula.
What a good question. I don't remember. I just know they asked me to do it, and I thought, oh, I love this. I auditioned for it at Disney. You always do. God bless them. They're one of the best theatrical companies in our country to work for. And I'm not saying that to get more work, but they really are. I mean, they're a marvelous theatrical company. Very classy. Who would you expect that? I forgot how I was called. I was called to audition, which I was delighted to do, which we always are for Disney. And I got it. And I think because I was the loudest. But oh, what a wonderful role. Oh my goodness, wasn't that fun?
When you got that role, because it's a character, it's
yes,
not
it
a person.
Is. No.
How did you see Ursula?
I saw Ursula the way she was drawn, and I tried to put a voice in her, and the voice that I came up with was the one that I thought belonged to her.
That is not the voice you're talking. What is Ursula's voice? When you record something as Ursula, what do you do different?
Ursula's more than that. Her voice is deeper, and more forceful. She's pushier. She's meaner. And she's the best of everything.
You know, Pat, you talked about something there that I think is very important. You talked about being loud. These villainous characters are loud.
Yeah.
Why is that important from an actor's standpoint?
It's easier to be mean if you're loud. The energy that loudness permits you seems to help you be mean, you know, and loudness seems to be for characters who are not sweet little dimpled ingenues.
You've been listening to highlights from an unforgettable trip that took place in late May of 2017. Scott, Sean, and Terry in New York City to visit Phil Donahue, the amazing Kreskin, and famous zoologist Jim Fowler, plus a bonus trip to Cape Cod to visit with Pat Carroll. This is Adam Lipp. Thank you, as always, for listening to The Talking Place, WWGH Radio.